Hello, this is Andy Bobick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the May 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article, a collaboration between John Lennon and Paul McCartney, and then a review about Questlove's documentary about Sly and the Family Stone, and a classic album review of Nothing Like the Sun by Sting. Okay, we begin today's program with the collaboration between John Lennon and Paul McCartney. This is titled A Right Pair. Two halves of one brain, John Lennon and Paul McCartney form the most extraordinary and intimate musical partnership of the rock era. In this extract from a new book that probes their bond through the medium of their songs, Ian Leslie discovers how one of them, Sgt. Pepper's Getting Better, was a case of Paul reaching out to John, changed but also estranged by his new love, LSD. And here's a little bit of that song, Getting Better, by the Beatles.
Getting better all the time. I used to get mad in my school.
No, I can't complain.
The teachers that taught me weren't cool.
No, I can't complain.
They're holding me down, turning me round, filling me up with your rules. I've got to admit, it's getting better.
On the evening of March 21st, 1967, three of the Beatles were at Abbey Road recording backing vocals for a song called Getting Better. John, Paul, and George were gathered around a microphone. After a few run-throughs, John took out a sliver snuff box, a silver snuff box he kept his pills in, and began poking around in it, searching for an upper to keep him going. Soon afterwards, he faltered and stopped in the middle of a line. He looked up to George Martin in the control room. "George, I'm not feeling too good," he said. "I'm not focusing on me." Martin paused the session and took John up to the roof for some fresh air. The other Beatles stayed behind. But as McCartney and Harrison discussed what might be the matter with John, they figured out that he had probably taken a tab of LSD by accident, and that maybe standing on the top of a building wasn't the best place for him. They rushed up the stairs, hoping that John did not decide to see if he could fly before they got there. As it turned out, he was okay. Still, work was halted for the night, and the band dispersed. Paul and John stayed together. With the drug exerting its effects on his brain, John didn't want to travel back to his home in Surrey. He and Paul headed for Paul's house on Cavendish Avenue, a short drive from the studio. Once there, Paul decided he would take some LSD himself. Although he had tried acid for the first time in late 1965, that was with other friends. Now he wanted to get with John, as he later put it to Martin, who interpreted it to mean to be with him in his misery and fear. McCartney told Barry Miles, "I thought maybe this is the moment. It's been coming for a long time." That night, John and Paul did something that the two of them practiced quite a few times during this period. They gazed intensely into each other's eyes. They liked to put their faces close together and stare, unblinking, until they felt themselves dissolving into each other, almost obliterating any sense of themselves as distinct individuals. There's something disturbing about it, recalls McCartney much later in his understated way. You ask yourself, how do you come back from it? How do you then lead a normal life after that? And the answer is, you don't. The Beatles publicist and friend, Derek Taylor, recalled Paul enthusing about LSD. We had this fantastic thing, incredible, really, just looked into each other's eyes. Like just staring and then saying, I know, man, and then laughing. John and Paul were getting toward the end of their work on what had become the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album. They were working on what they called slog songs. The last four songs of an album are usually pretty slog, Paul told Hunter Davis around this time. If we need four more, we just have to get down and do them. They're not necessarily worse than ones done out of imagination. They're often better because by that stage in an LP, we know what sort of songs we want. By songs done out of imagination, Paul meant those that one or the other of them already had floating around. Before sessions on an album began, like Eleanor Rigby, Tomorrow Never Knows, or A Day in the Life, those songs arrived unbidden and were sometimes fragmentary or unfinished. Once the group had realized these ones in the studio, they usually needed a few more and often had a tight deadline. So John and Paul would meet up, usually around 2 p.m, and knock out the slog songs. It was like the difference between letting inspiration strike and trying very hard to have a new idea. On that basis, you might expect the slog songs to sound more formulaic and less interesting. But because John and Paul were so relaxed in each other's company, they were able to tap into each other's unconscious and find surprises there. In 1967, the journalist Hunter Davies got as close as any outsider did to witnessing this process. He was at McCartney's house as John and Paul worked on a song for Ringo. They had composed the melody the day before. They had a title too, with a little help from my friends. Davies described the two of them in a seemingly aimless, almost trance-like state. They would bang away, artlessly on guitars, or Paul would sit at the piano. They'd throw out musical and lyrical phrases until something that one of them did or said snagged, at which point the other would pluck it out of a mass of noises and try it himself. As Davies watches, they land on the idea of asking a question at the start of each verse. At this point, Cynthia Lennon turns up with one of their old Liverpool friends, Terry Doran. Cynthia and Terry sit down, chat quietly, suggest lines, then invited to and read out loud the horoscope, while Paul and John carry on doodling. Paul suddenly starts to play Can't Buy Me Love. John joins in, singing it very loudly, laughing and shouting. Paul plays tequila on the piano, and they go crazy again. Remember in Germany, says John, we used to shout out anything. John and Paul play through their song, but with John shouting random words between the lines. Knickers, Hitler, Tit, Duke of Edinburgh. It's the kind of moment familiar to anyone who has watched Get Back. This period of boisterous play stops as soon as it began. They return to the song, now very focused and speaking softly. John finds just the right words to make a line he has been working on, scan. Paul nods, says, yes, that will do, and writes down the finished verse on notepad. Davies was also around to see how getting better came into being. McCartney had been at home with time to kill. John was meant to be coming over to work on new songs, but he was late. And it was a nice day, so Paul picked up Martha, the sheepdog he had acquired the previous summer, put her in his Mini Cooper, and drove to Primrose Hill. As Martha frolicked in the park and the sun came out for the first time in a while, Paul thought, it's getting better, and smiled. The phrase reminded him of something Jimmy Nicole used to say. Nicole was the drummer who joined the band for a few weeks in 1964 when Ringo fell ill. Whenever one of the Beatles asked Nicole how he was finding it, he'd reply, it's getting better. The Beatles found this hilarious. When John arrived at Cavendish Avenue later that afternoon, Paul said, let's do a song called Getting Better. They began strumming and improvising and larking around until a song began to form. You've got to admit, said Paul after a while, it is getting better. And John started to sing that. The two of them kept going like this until 2 a.m, stopping only for a fry-up as a succession of visitors who had made appointments to see Paul were left waiting or sent away. Into this song, initiated by Paul, John poured a stream of reflections on his own life, on the anger he had carried around with him as a teenager and younger man, on the emotional and physical abuse he had inflicted on women. Since the tone of the song is lighthearted, the heaviness of the final verse is often missed. The evening after this session, John and Paul went to the studio. Paul played Getting Better on a piano for George and Ringo. The group sat around and discussed what the song should sound like before dispersing to noodle on their instruments, trying out bits and pieces to play. Paul joined Ringo at the drums and helped him work out his part. After a couple of hours, they were ready to record the backing track. George Martin took his position in the control room. The Beatles ran through 7 takes, with Paul directing the group. Once more drums, less bass. By midnight, they had a satisfactory version. 12 days later, they recorded the lead and backing vocals. This was the session interrupted by John's LSD-induced freakout. 2 days after that, reported Hunter Davies, they were back in the studio to redo the vocals, finishing when they'd got it at least to a stage which didn't make them unhappy. People who knew John complimented on a change in his personality that took place in 1966 and 1967, roughly coinciding with his use of pot and LSD. In early 1968, Cynthia told Hunter Davies that John was quieter and more tolerant than he used to be. His old schoolmate, Pete Shotten, also noticed a distinct softening of John's personality. The cripple impersonation stopped, the sarcasm receded. He was no longer drinking himself into oblivion and rage. His songwriting moved past the Sturm und Drang of love, betrayed, and spurned. He became calmer, nicer, and more childlike. He even started hugging people. This is the new thing, John said, on hugging a friend he hadn't seen in a while. You hug your friends when you meet them and show them you're glad to see them. He also stopped worrying about McCartney taking leadership of the group. As Lennon relaxed, McCartney became even more driven. Although Paul had now taken LSD with John, his drug of choice during the Pepper sessions was cocaine. In the studio, after the others had clocked off, he would work through the night, crafting his bass lines, obsessing over every detail of each track. John's drug-enabled placidity came at a cost. He was taking acid frequently now, sometimes with a group of hangers-on that he would invite back to Kenwood after a night out in the clubs. Cynthia and Julian got used to strangers in the house. They'd wander around, glassy-eyed, crash out on the sofas, beds, and floors, then eat whatever they could find in the kitchen, Cynthia wrote in her memoir. John was an essentially private man, but under the influence of drugs, he was vulnerable to anyone and everyone who wanted to take advantage of him. John's use of LSD put an ever greater distance between him and Cynthia. In the spring of 1967, he invited Pete Shotten to move into Kenwood, primarily so that he would have someone to take it with. The first time they took it together was at Julian's fourth birthday party. After that, John would bring a mug of tea and a tab of acid to Shootin's room every morning. Not surprisingly, John's productivity suffered. He had never found it so hard to create new songs, other than A Day in the Life. Only three of the songs on Sgt. Pepper were initiated by him: Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, and Good Morning, Good Morning. Even on those, McCartney was the midwife. Although John claimed Kite as his, McCartney remembers being at John's house, pointing to the circus poster that inspired it and helping John turn its copy into lyrics. Paul co-wrote Lucy Too. The number of created Lennon and McCartney songs on Pepper, at least six, feature significant writing contributions from both of them, is testament to their closeness at this time, but also to how much Paul was now having to coax songs out of his partner. Nobody, not even John, believed more in John's talents than Paul, or was more deeply invested in him making the most of them. McCartney also wanted his friend to be happy. He could see that John was calmer than he had been. He could also see that John was unmoored. When John wasn't working, he was tripping, left to drift aimlessly. He might lose himself altogether. By choosing to take LSD with him, Paul was giving John a chance to take the upper hand in at least one aspect of their relationship, to play the role of psychedelic guide, while ensuring that the drug's mind-expanding properties were channeled into creativity. In Getting Better, Paul nudged John into creating a kind of self-help narrative of his own life, sung paradoxically by Paul. The narrative is commented on wappishly by John, "Fool, you fool," playing a Greek chorus in the drama of his own maturation. The singer has been helped to put aside the self-loathing and rage of his youth by, well, someone. His realization is arrived at grudgingly as something he has to admit, just as you might acknowledge a friend who often annoys you, but who is busy saving you from yourself. Okay, here's a side article, Head to Head. Five more times John and Paul's interplay made a good song great. If I Fell from A Hard Day's Night, 1964. Lennon and McCartney share vocals on A Hard Day's Night's not-so-secret weapon, evidence of how Paul's, the song's primary writer, John could be when he chose. Neither a conventional vocal, BV combo, nor a duet, John and Paul's lines weave, writes Ian Leslie, like a courtship dance. And here's a little bit of the song, If I Fell, by the Beatles.
Be true and help me understand, 'cause I've been in love before, and I found that love was more than just holding hands.
Another song that Paul and John interplay made good song great is In My Life from Rubber Soul 1965. As Leslie notes, the song Lennon and McCartney subsequently disagreed most about as to who wrote what, they're John's lyrics an autobiographical precursor to Strawberry Fields Forever. Paul later laid claim to the melody, a bit bluesy, with the minors and little harmonies. And here's the song, In My Life.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone, and some remain.
Okay, another John and Paul song, Tomorrow Never Knows, from Revolver, 1966. Still impossible to fully comprehend how the pair conceived this, even when you know the full story of John's spectral acid demo transformed by Paul instigated tape experiment. Not just John plus Paul, but the invention of a Beatle entity that was both them and beyond them. And here's part of the song, Tomorrow Never Knows, by the Beatles. Another Lennon and McCartney collaboration, A Day in the Life. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, 1967. The best example of the John Paul yin and yang. That with the John bit and the Paul bit being tantamount to two different songs. A bet linked by a theme of profound inner reflection. Collaged together. Post-Beatles, John songs would miss Paul's levity, and Paul's songs lack John's intensity. And here's a little bit of the song, A Day in the Life, by the Beatles.
He did didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure he was from the House of Lords.
In the final Lennon and McCartney collaboration, the song Two of Us from Let It Be 1970. Paul wrote this after a car journey with Linda, but it's hard not to parse as a flashback to the heyday of Lennon and McCartney's partnership, especially when you watch Paul and John croon it a deluxe in Get Back. Get a room, you can almost see Harrison thinking, just before he does a bunk. And here's the song, Two of Us, by the Beatles.
On the Deaf Aids. Phase one, in which Doris gets her oats.
Two of us riding nowhere, spending someone.
Here's another side article titled Temperatures Rising. A new film about John Lennon and Yoko Ono's radical 1971-73 is full of fear, intimacy, and great music. I was completely floored, Sean Lennon tells Danny Exelston. It's 1972 and John Lennon is talking to drummer Jim Keltner on the phone about a tour he's planning that will end in Miami Beach to coincide with a protest at August Republican National Convention. The ex-Beatle ongoing challenge to President Nixon and the U.S. political establishment has him buzzing, but Keltner sounds a note of concern. Does Lennon realize he's playing with fire? Has he considered the risks? Lifted from a recently discovered box of tapes, the audio is one of the stars of One to One, John and Yoko, Kevin MacDonald and Sam Rice Edwards' vivid and visceral new film about Lennon and Yoko Ono's period of controversial activism, 1971 to 73. The pair's recorded phone conversations with Keltner, Alan Klein, MC5 manager John Sinclair, and more provide some of the film's most surprising insights. One viewer was particularly struck. I was completely floored, Sean Lennon tells Mojo. I think maybe not everyone realizes how special it is for me to hear my dad talking or to see him. I grew up with a set number of images and audio clips that everyone's familiar with. So to come across things that I've never seen or heard is really deep for me, because it's almost like getting more time with my dad. One to One is full of such moments of surprising connection with the Lennons. The phone recordings provide what co-director Kevin MacDonald describes as one of the film's spines. The other is restored footage of the one full live show Lennon performed as a solo artist, the Madison Square Garden benefit for Staten Island's Willow Brook Special Needs School on August 30th, 1972. Backed by their New York pickup band, Elephant's Memory, with Keltner on second kit, Lennon and Ono deliver searing performances of Come Together, Cold Turkey, Mother, Don't Worry, Kyoko, and more. After decades of mixed reviews for this period of Lennon's music making, encompassing some time in New York City, and our previous best version of the Willowbrook Show, the 1986 release of Live in New York City is another revelation. To be honest, I don't know what was going on that day, but the recording was very chaotic, says Sean Lennon, who presided over the gig's new audio mix, battling random mic placements, tidying flammy drums, and foregrounding Lennon's vocals. Dad's amazing at that show, he continues, specifically his voice. It's got grit to it. Let's just say, if I was in a band with John Lennon, I wouldn't solo over his voice when he's singing. Lennon chuckles. Let's just put it that way. Collage TV footage of contemporary events contextualizes the Lennon's activism. Carol Faraci of the Super Square Ray Conniff Singers unveiling a Stop the Killing banner at a White House concert, and you emphasize with their idealism. Flower power didn't work, says Lennon, but so what? We start again. Yet the film doesn't flinch from the less savory aspects of their radical allies, Jerry Rubin, who wants to empty the prisons, A.J. Weberman, who roots through Bob Dylan's garbage for evidence of his betrayal of the movement, and syringes. To me, ultimately, the message of the film is that they were very brave, John and Yoko, to go from singing songs to hanging out with the Chicago Seven, hanging out with the Black Panthers, and becoming real radical activists, says Sean Lennon. But you see that it goes too far, and you can feel that my dad is scared. I think a lot of people today remember my dad's activism as aligning with the Jerry Rubins. But he moves beyond that when he realizes they're violent too, or they want to be violent, and it's a cold splash of water in the face. Ultimately, it transpired that Lennon was right to be scared. The clicks and whirls that we hear on the phone recordings really were FBI taps. And while the Lennons deployed private investigators to track down Yoko's estranged daughter, Kyoko, they briefed lawyers to counter threats of deportation. A higher profile in 1972's election campaign could conceivably have ended as it did for segregationist Democrat George Wallace, paralyzed after taking four shots in Laurel, Maryland on May 15th. More than anything, One-to-One is a snapshot of a man on a voyage of self-discovery. What was John Lennon if no longer a Beatle? For now, he was a revolutionary. Later, he'd be a drunk, a penitent, a father, and a saint. It's especially important to realize John and Yoko moved past this period, and they became artists again, says Sean Lennon. When people ask me, what would your dad think of this or that event? I always say, whatever he would think now would not be what he would thought then. That's all I fucking know. Okay, now we move on to the article about Questlove and his documentary about Sly and the Family Stone. And this is titled Stone Immaculate. Questlove questions the system that destroyed a revolutionary star. Sly lives, a.k.a. the burden of black genius. Directed by Amir Questlove Thompson. Late into Sly Lives, Amir Questlove Thompson's thoughtful documentary about the explosive brilliance of Sly Stone and the band he built, the drummer and filmmaker, poses a provocative question to his assembled celebrities. Is there a burden on black genius? Nearly 2 hours earlier, the film begins with a fruitless quest to define that term before implicitly offering Stone as one possible answer. A charismatic, multi-instrumental wonder who channeled the fractures and possibilities of the late 60s into anthems that recombined most everything. D'Angelo, who emerges as a kind of one-man Greek chorus, so critical for Sly Lives, is the first to answer, you do have to do it for everyone, and everybody else's success rides on your success. Thompson's film does not shy away from such larger cultural vexations and social quandaries, be they racism, addiction, privilege, or mental health disorders. The basics of Stone's story, after all, can seem like the standard fare of rock star rise and fall. A spirited kid with religious roots slips into the psychedelic scene of San Francisco, builds a mighty band with flair and finesse, and then succumbs to the excesses of success, but somehow survives to become a grinning grandfather. Stone, 81, is not interviewed, but Thompson does not use recent candid photos of him, proof that his smile still electrifies. Thompson does not pretend there are easy answers or ready fixes, but instead lets his worries unspool into the present, crossing out the eyes of black artists like Lauryn Hill and Dave Chappelle on screen, as Vernon Reid asks, "Who do you think you are? What do you think you're doing?" In 2025, in the United States, those points retain a cruel power and afford Sly Lives a bittersweet staying power. Sly Lives taps Thompson's deep roster with the reclusive like of D'Angelo and Andre 3000, joining George Clinton, Chaka Khan, and a half dozen members of the family Stone, or Stone's actual family. Thompson deploys them not just to analyze Stone's story, but also his revolutionary music, which slipped protest messages into irrepressible party anthems. Thompson lifts the curtain on the seemingly intermirable takes of everyday people, while Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis dig into the inner workings of its book after explaining the mechanics of the meter in Dance to the Music. And here's a little bit of that song, Dance to the Music, by Sly and the Family Stone.
Some bottom so that the dancers just won't hide.
Q-Tip and Thompson lead over a sampler, nodding their heads as they excise a Family Stone drum beat and explain how those rhythms became hip-hop's vertebrae. Sly Lives plays for the heads as well as those simply looking for a story that's poignant and thoughtful. I hate to say it, but these white rock and rollers, the motherfuckers go out in style, D'Angelo says near the end, long after Q-Tip suggests that Stone and black stars like him never received the same reinventive leeway as, say, David Bowie. They die in their tomato garden with their grandson, laughing and shit. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Sly Lives is a true celebration of the hibernized music Stone made and a relentless rebuke of the systems that then made him suffer for it. It is the rare music documentary with the vision to look beneath and around the sound, too. And here's what we've learned. Stone's junior college music professor, Dave Frolick, encouraged him to leave school. You don't need it anymore. Also, Stone produced and essentially arranged The Great Society's Someone to Love, the precursor to the Jefferson Airplane hit. Saxophonist Jerry Martini was the member who told Stone it was time to start playing. If we do a band, Martini remembers saying, we'll all be famous. Stand inspired Nile Rodgers when he was a subsection leader for the Black Panther Party. And here's a little bit of that song, Stand, by Sly and the Family Stone.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal.
Finally, is that Rhythm Nation? Janet Jackson asked when she walked into the studio to find Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis sampling Stone. They all agreed it was. You be the judge. Here's the song Rhythm Nation by Janet Jackson. I don't know, that sounds pretty close to me. Okay, now we get to the classic album of the week, and this week it is Sting's Nothing Like the Sun. Happy 35th anniversary to Sting's second album, Nothing Like the Sun, originally released October 13th, 1987. Following on from the gargantuan success of The Police, Sting's turn as solo artist proved just as potent with the release of 1985's jazz-infused The Dream of the Blue Turtles. Showing his ability to draw influence from several styles of music whilst still making it sound authentic as opposed to co-opted, Sting set about writing and recording his sophomore effort, 1987's Nothing Like the Sun. As a newly minted teen at the time, the music and artist I listened to often shaped my worldview. The global consciousness of albums such as U2's The Joshua Tree, 1987, and Simple Minds' Once Upon a Time, 1985. Along with artist support of organizations like Amnesty International, broadened my concerns and motivated me to act in a way that only a righteous teen can. So it was somewhat fitting that the release of Nothing Like the Sun occurred during an overseas trip with my family. I can remember vividly buying the album on cassette, hiding it into my Walkman, pressing play, and being greeted with an album that felt like a warm, organic global stew, cooked up by one serious-minded chef. Written and recorded following Sting's involvement with Amnesty International's Conspiracy of Hope tour, it was clear that being exposed to some of the unjust heartache during tour stops through Latin America not only opened Sting's eyes to the issues of government oppression and the ravages of civil war, but also the music of the region. Coupled with this was Sting's personal struggle dealing with the illness and ultimate loss of his mother that transpired in the lead-up to and recording of the album. Songs like album opener The Lazarus Heart melt these two themes perfectly as he weaves world music-inspired percussive elements with jazz fusion and laments, mortality, singing, birds, on the roof of my mother's house, no stones to chase them away. Birds on the roof of my mother's house will sit on my roof someday. The song grooves under the propulsion of famed session drummer Manu Katché and floats dreamlike with Branford Marsalis. Haunting saxophone melody as Sting confronts his own mortality, the loss of his mother, and what it means to be a parent. And here's a little bit of that song, The Lazarus Heart, from Sting. On tracks like the somber yet hopeful They Dance Alone, which amplifies the plight of Chile's Mothers of the Disappeared, the tender acoustic solace of Fragile, and the melancholy of Sister Moon, Sting takes on serious issues in a way that shines with an authentic concern, elevating the material from being overly dour. And here's a little bit of the song Sister Moon, by Sting.
shadows I would hide. All good people asleep tonight. I'm all by myself in your silver light. I would gaze at your face the whole night through. I'd go out of my mind but for you. I'd go out of my mind but for you.
In fact, the only upbeat songs on the set are the funk pop of lead single We'll Be Together and the throwaway shuffle retelling of Noah's Ark, Rock Steady. While the former shines all these years later, the latter is best soon forgotten. And here's a little bit of the song, We'll Be Together by Sting. Reflective, Be Still, My Beating Heart, enchants with its ebb and flow arrangement and features the earthroll soundscapes of the Police's Andy Summers on guitar, coupled with the evergreen jazz of Englishmen in New York and its humorous take on being a stranger in a strange land. They form the centerpiece of the album's first disc and play to the strengths of the ensemble musicians. And here's some of the song Englishman in New York by Sting.
I don't drink coffee, I take tea, my dear. My toast on one side. You can hear it in my accent when I talk. I'm an Englishman in New York. You see me walking down Fifth Avenue, a walking cane here at my side.
Where the percussively dense and lyrically insightful History Will Teach Us Nothing and the enchanting hypnotic Straight to My Heart keep the album's lifeblood pumping with vigor. Another standout is Sting's cover of Jimi Hendrix's Little Wing, ably assisted by jazz pioneer Gil Evans, which takes on an earthrow quality and aptly soars to the heavens. Album closer, The Secret Marriage, feels like the tacked-on song to an overly long credit sequence, and as a result, the album suffers a bit from its inclusion. And here's Sting's cover of Jimi Hendrix's Little Wing.
Well, she's walking through the clouds where the circus man running around. Butterflies and zebras and moonbeams and fairy tales. Oh, she ever talks about riding with the wind.
with a thousand smiles. She could show me free. It's alright, she said. Take anything you want from me.
Whilst its energy might fizzle a little in the final quarter, salvaged by Little Wing, Nothing Like the Sun remains an ever-enjoyable listen that places you in a reflective mood and allows you space to crawl inside the music. Surprisingly successful for what it is, for all intents and purposes, a decidedly non-commercial sounding album, it remains one of Sting's finest and most cohesive moments on record. Well worth dusting off and giving another spin. And here's a little bit of one of my favorite songs from that album, History Will Teach Us Nothing by Sting. And once again, unfortunately, we're all out of time. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the May 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. If you are a big Queen fan, like I am, you definitely won't want to miss next week's show. I'm devoting the entire hour to Mojo's cover story about Queen. And a classic album review next week of Electric Warrior by T-Rex. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
Without the breath of real freedom, we're getting nowhere fast.